win already, fun. I'm thankful to be here this morning and have an opportunity to talk to you about some things. I can't tell you how much I love you all. To be able to be here in a group of people who want to come together and worship God, who want to study His Word, and to love one another. And those of you who are at home, I love you very much. And those of you who are here, I love you. I'm going to say some things this morning as we start to work our way around reaching the lost. And I guess I'm making my apology up front. My intent is to say things with gentleness and love. The things I'm saying, I certainly am saying to myself. Christianity has an image problem. Many in our culture think Christianity is silly, then they don't really have a use for it. Some believe that Christianity doesn't provide any value to the world around us. Hypocrite is the term often used to describe Christianity rather than a loving and living Christ. Science has become keen in the minds of most of the people I work around in the field that I'm in. And religion is viewed as a philosophy that does not answer any of the questions that demand an answer. Christianity suffers from an image problem in our culture. You know, when we look at Paul talking to the Jews, we see a certain approach that he has. When we see him in Athens, he has a different approach. I think it's an approach that's more relevant to the things that we see in our world. I don't really have a lot of conversations where I'm talking to people about Judaism and Christ. And we are faced with many in our culture who are now asking, where has Christianity gotten us? I heard that question just this week. This is happening because they did not see, feel, or observe the love that Jesus described in John chapter 13 in verses 34 and 35 when he gives us that new commandment to love the way that he loves, to love each other that way so that the world will see that and know that we are the ones that are his disciples. Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Christianity suffers from an image problem. And I just want to tell you, it's my fault. If you agree with that statement that it's my fault, you can raise your hand now. Yeah. Now, if I said if you would include yourself in that, you know, I guess we would get more hands. Let me assure you of one thing, if you wonder about that statement. It's not God's fault. The fact that Christianity has an image problem is not God's fault. It's my fault. And not only does Christianity have problems, but Christians have image problems. And let me define it for you. Really simply, image. The definition of image. The image of a person, group, or organization is the way that they appear to other people. That's how you appear to other people. Problem. A problem is a situation that is unsatisfactory and causes difficulties for people. You see, Christians have an image problem by the way that we are viewed. You know, and as we tick around our growth cycle here, I start to realize something about this. When we get to the idea of reaching the lost, you know what's happening? I'm the one that's lost. In many different ways, I'm lost because I really don't know how to do this well. I've lived on this planet for a long time, and I'm still not good at this. We need to clean up the mess in the world a little bit and how we interact with it, and certainly the perception. We are the ones that are responsible. We sing that song, "He has no hands but our hands." There's some truth in that. The Christians in this room and the ones who are watching online, we face a challenge because everyone that we meet in the world has a belief about God, about the world. They have a belief and an understanding about themselves. The Stoics and the Epicurean philosophers of Paul's day, I like to suggest, still exist today. And Paul wrote this in Colossians chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Colossians 2. "For I want you to know how great a struggle I have on your behalf, and for those who are at Laodicea, and for all those who have not personally seen my face, that their hearts may be encouraged, having been knit together in love, and attaining to all the wealth that comes from the full assurance of understanding, resulting in a true knowledge of God's mystery, and that is Christ himself, in whom are hidden all the," and he refers to them here as treasures, "all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge." And that's the way we should look at wisdom and knowledge, as being a treasure. You see, when Christians are woven into a tapestry of love and in touch with everything that there is to know of God, if that's even possible, then their minds are confident and at rest. They are focused on Christ. They are focused on God's great mystery. I'm pretty sure those are the types of things that Paul is focused on as he heads into Athens and focused on the richest treasures in the world, wisdom and knowledge that are from Jesus, treasures embedded in that mystery and not found anywhere else. And Paul goes on to say, I'm telling you this in verse 4, I say this so that no one will delude you with persuasive argument. And in a world where everybody's got a lot of things, I think I heard it in class, as we have a lot of options, where there's a lot of options for us to pursue, Paul found himself in Athens in that same situation, and he makes an argument himself. Paul doesn't want anyone leading you off on some wild goose chase. We need to be in front of this. We need to be thinkers. Now, in fact, you really have no choice in that, I know. We all are thinkers. I think, therefore I am. I think the only thing that I would suggest is that since we're going to be thinkers, we want to be good thinkers. And if you're going to go through the process of thinking, you need to be thinking about the great I am. I think, therefore, I think about the great I am. Our thoughts and where we put our minds need to be a focus on God. But there are many choices, as that was brought up, and many things that will take our mind and steal it away from us. Western culture is disenchanted, though. It's disillusioned and disappointed. It no longer sees the world as it truly is. Instead of the Western culture seeing this as the way it really is, which is reality as being sacred and beautiful, the way that God made it, it is often viewed as mundane, ordinary, and familiar. And here's my fear. As Christians, if we continue to pursue the many gods of our culture, and there's a lot of them out there, if we continue to take all those options on and follow all those options, then the true God of heaven will become the unknown God. It's a powerful statement that's used there about this unknown God, but how do you think he became unknown? I think it's clever to look at how Paul handles this, but on top of all of this, it did some damage. All those gods, all those things to pursue. We need to be good thinkers. We need to reach the lost with the gospel of Jesus. You know, when we think about the Gospels, we think like the song. We sing Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But you need to be thinking about the fifth Gospel. You see, you are the fifth Gospel. How are we going to be the fifth Gospel? How are you going to be the fifth Gospel in this culture? So I want to tell you a story. I'm going to keep it brief. I'm going to tell you a story about what I'm getting at. So this will kind of set the pace for the rest of the things I say. Without me actually having to say them, I tell a story once and you'll get the idea. My son Wayne was preaching over in St. Pete, and he met a woman who was not a Christian, and he started to work through teaching her the gospel. He was trying to build a bridge to communicate to her the importance of being baptized and becoming a Christian. And he finally got her to come to church. And after church on a Sunday, they, as their practice is, they all went out to eat. And she's getting to see the Christians. This is an opportunity for her to see Christians loving one another the way that Christ commanded us to. And at the lunch, one of the members of the church there, who felt rather politically motivated, brings up politics. And as the conversation unfolds, a particular party is announced at this table, and anybody that was a part of a party like that is an idiot. He lost that Bible study, that woman, that was it. That was it. Who are we going to put first? What God is our favorite God here? Who is our favorite God, and who do we put first? How are you going to be the fifth gospel in this culture? Most people in our culture never read the first four, so the only interaction they have with the gospel might just be you and how they see you and how you interact with them. And that's important. And while it may be true that religion has increased in the 21st century, The Western culture has become largely anti-Christian. I've talked to Brian about this before, the question, are you a Christian? Over the years, I've answered this different ways. You know, what religion are you? I told somebody one time I was a spiritual Jew, which opened up some interesting conversation. You know, I had a neighbor down the street, and as our conversation went on, he starts to become suspicious of me. And he says, well, do you drink beer? And I said, no. And he goes, are you a Christian? And I said, yes. He says, thought so. And he got mad, and he walked away. So I've had difficulties with that. I've been trying out something new. I've only tried it once, actually. But working through this, somebody asked me, are you a Christian? I looked at him and I said, I would hope that when you look at me and you see how I conduct myself and how I treat other people and how I act, that you would come to a conclusion like that. And the person smiled and said, so you are a Christian. I got this idea, of course, from Acts 11. Brian mentioned it. They were called Christians. It was an observation that was made by the way we conduct and handle ourselves. I'm afraid that this landscape of the current Western culture, that the culture has influenced us more than we have influenced the culture. I'm just being straight here. Who is influencing who here? We serve the mighty God of heaven. But the gospel doesn't fit into my busy contemporary life. And that has led me as a Christian for my voice to become muted. That's what happens. Our voice will become muted. The prophetic voice of all wisdom is just becoming a mere whisper in a culture. And we talked about it even in class about, you know, everything's okay except this. Well, there's a reason why it's being pushed to the back, and it's just a matter of time. But you are the fifth gospel, and you have been called to exercise this prophetic voice from the Bible. Let me tell you what happens when Christians don't do this. When Christians are silent, what happens is when Christians look at the world the same way as everybody else, and we get involved in all the same things that the rest of the world is getting involved in, what happens is God becomes the unknown God in our culture. The same thing that they had in Athens. We have a problem. It's just a matter of time. We need to ask ourselves, who is our favorite God? Is it our job? Is it our politics? Is it our money? Is it our favorite news network? Is it our country? If it is the God of heaven, then let's live like it. And if it is not the God of heaven, then let's repent. It's just that simple. This isn't a complex thing to understand. It's just, those are the choices. And I'm preaching to me, just like everyone else. Jesus' original intent was for ordinary people like you and me to live lives that point others to the only person who can give them hope. And that hope is supposed to not just be for this life, but for the life to come. To visibly display the good news of salvation, where they can see the Messiah and the Redeemer of humankind in the way that we conduct ourselves. We need to do this for the one who we profess to love. You know, actions speak louder than words. Let's get a better grasp on this as we look at and follow the lead of our dear brother, the Apostle Paul, as he engages the Greeks in Athens. You know, they had many gods and idols, and I'm sure that they had their, can you imagine with all these gods? Who's your favorite God? That question, probably people could answer that. Instead of, are you a Christian? You could be asking them, who's your favorite God? And they probably could give an answer. They had many of these, and this led to a culture and to a place where the one true God was basically unknown. I know that I could say that. I know you all are feeling that. I mean, those of you who have years on you like me, you've definitely seen this happening. So after being run out of Thessalonica and Berea, the Apostle Paul finds himself in Athens. He's there to await the arrival of Silas and Timothy. And here's what we read in Acts chapter 17 and verse 16. Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him, and he was observing the city full of idols. The first thing I want us to notice is that isn't even big enough to read. I should have come down here. I was like, I'll try to pick a smaller font next time. We worship that which we consider to be ultimate in our life. Whatever we make ultimate, that's what we worship. And Paul is greatly distressed as he is in this city because it is so full of idols. You know, he had come a long way, and he's now in the city of, we mentioned this, Socrates and Plato. You know, this is the place of the first university, Plato's Academy. Aristotle and Epicurus and Zeno and famous playwrights. And in verse 16, we observe that Paul could see and observe what was ultimate in the lives of the Athenians. I would like to suggest that we can do the same thing. We can look around us and size this up pretty easily. What is ultimate in the lives of the people that we encounter every day? He could see what they were worshiping by their actions. And what we are supposed to be worshiping is the true God who made us. Isaiah understood this. Isaiah said in Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 21, "The people whom I formed for myself will declare my praise." Jesus knew this. In Matthew chapter 4, starting in verse 8, as Satan is tempting him, again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, "All these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me." And then Jesus said to him, "Go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Those are very strong words. We have been created by God to worship, to respond to him, to love him, to worship him, to delight in him, to enjoy him. All human life is lived in response to God, either in communion with him or in active or passive rebellion against him. You know, sounds kind of either or, black and white. God made the choices simple. Selfishness is no doubt a part of this. I'm sure that Satan hits that and uses that as well. And just so we can know for certain, because I want everybody to understand this for certain, Paul explains what will happen with certainty. And that's the word he uses here. What was going to happen for certainty if we do not consider God to be ultimate in our lives? If we have all those plans, B's, and the second gods, you can be assured of this with certainty. Ephesians 5:5, "For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." You know, the way that's written, we should be running away from that, not running towards it. Don't be duped. Brethren, it is no different in our day and age. We need to use caution. We need to open our eyes because idolatry is everywhere. And whenever you look, man has erected a god that he worships everywhere. It might be in the form of things that are not statues, but they're there nonetheless. What is our culture considering ultimate? Because that's what they worship. People worship what they consider to be ultimate in life. That's either the worship of the true God or idolatry. It's no wonder that we restarted this section that Paul is distressed. We should be distressed. There are some things to be distressed over, but it's not all lost either. In Acts chapter 17 and verse 23, he says, "For while I was passing through and examining," he's examining the objects of your worship, "I also found," he's finding, he's discovering, "an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." The second observation I want you to, I've got behind here. The second observation I want you to see is that Paul did not stumble into these altars. He was examining the objects. He was making an examination, trying to find. He went looking for them. He did his homework and he discovered what was all over the city, and what he discovered that was all over that city is all over our entire nation. While he was examining the objects of their worship, he discovered something. It was an altar with an inscription on it. There was a man whose name is Epimenides. 500 years before Paul was ever there, what we know about Epimenides is basically from a few fragments. We know that he was in Athens. We know he was a poet. We have a few fragments of his writing. And everything else we know about him is lost in legend, even legends that existed during his time. And so this is right around the 500 years before Paul is there. It's right around the 46th Olympiad. And you won't believe what happened. A pandemic happened in this town. And this pandemic that took place took the life of one-third of the people. It was a plague that killed their population. And so Epimenides was called to come there and help with the situation. And what the people did is they started to pray and offer and pray and offer to all these gods, and people just kept on dying. And as that happened, he was the one that suggested, let's make an altar to an unknown god. And so they did. And because of the way they did it, which is a much longer story, these altars end up all over Athens to the unknown god. And they make the offering, and the plague stopped. Now, that's the legend based on fact. Many people believe that verse 28, that he's the poet that Paul is referring to here. I believe that Paul did his homework when talking to the Athenians. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves is, are we going to do our homework? Are we going to be prepared to talk to the culture around us? Are we ready to reach the lost? Because that is a trilling question. You know, how far away are we from having an unknown god? If we continue to pursue idols, we will get there sooner than we want. And I keep forgetting that I have that header, so let me just go to the next one. The third observation that I want us to see is that Paul affirms what he can affirm. You know, whenever he's dealing with people that he does not have much in common with these people. He's a Jew, and this is very offensive. All these pagan gods, and he doesn't have a lot, but you know what he does. He affirms what he can affirm in the Athenian culture. Now, I want to look at a couple other verses to see what Paul's thinking is on this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, here's what he says in verses 31 through 33. He says, whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, so that they may be saved. He understood what he was doing. Sometimes you have to keep your thoughts to yourself because there's something much, much greater at stake here. He wanted to save many. He says this in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, one chapter before, verses 22 through 23. He says, to the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. That's what we need to do. We need to do all things for the gospel. If we're going to reach the lost, we're going to have to develop this. We're going to have to pray about this. We're going to have to get good at this. We're going to have to leave all the options of this world to the back burner and bring this to the forefront. This needs to be what's ultimate in our life. We need to get excited about this. We need to get worked up about this. I'm looking at a world, people are getting excited and worked up all over all sorts of things. We need to do that with the gospel. Paul recognized that he was the fifth gospel. He understood this. Paul knew what he was doing with this. Even in their idolatry, Paul recognizes that that the Athenians attempt to grope after God. And so he identified that as the common ground and the starting point that he would use. And that's what we need to do. We need to look for that common ground. And Paul is saying, let me tell you the true nature of this God whom you worship and do not know. This is the God I'm going to proclaim to you. And so Paul begins to do his speech. And what he's doing here is he is building a bridge from the Athenian culture to the gospel. And that's what you do. You look for ways to build that bridge. So the fourth observation, Paul outmaneuvers their thinking. Paul proclaims the unknown God is the one in Acts 17, verse 24, who made the world and all things in it. And since he is Lord of heaven and earth, he does not dwell in temples made with hands. Paul proclaims that the unknown God is the Creator. Paul proclaims that the unknown God does not need the human race, and Brian touched on this, to run errands for him. It's not like the church has to take care of God or the people take care of God. It's not like he couldn't take care of himself. But in that, Paul proclaims that he is the sustainer, not served by human hands, since he himself gives to all people. Many in our culture believe that they are sustaining themselves. And Paul proclaims that the unknown God, he is not just the creator, he is not just the sustainer, he is also the ordainer, the one who enacts and establishes absolutely everything. Starting from scratch, he made the entire human race. Verse 26 says that he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. He is our ordainer. And as such, he made the earth hospitable with plenty of time and space for living. And then in verse 27, that they would seek God, and perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and exist, even as some of your own poets said, for we also are his children. Paul proclaims that we are his children. Paul confronts the sin of idolatry that is in their midst. Paul proclaims that the offspring, the children of God, of the unknown God, who is creator, sustainer, and ordainer, he confronts those children with their sin. In verse 29, being then children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. And Paul is, now that he's got this bridge built, he starts to break the conversation out of orbit, out of the world culture of the Greek thinkers. He's got them now, and he's going to spin this out. And this is a methodology that you could use. He does this to introduce them to the realities about the God that they do not know. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all everywhere should repent. That's blunt. Because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men. And how did he do that? By raising him from the dead. Paul now teaches that their idols are inconsistent. These idols are inconsistent with the belief in a personal creator type of God. He built this bridge, and now when you look at the idols, they just don't stack up. Your idols did not create you. Your idols are not sustaining you. Your idols are not the ordainer that sets all the boundaries. And you are not the offspring of your idols. They are the offspring of you. Looking anywhere else short of God to meet your needs is, in fact, and indeed, idolatry. It's an empty pursuit. There's nothing there at the end of that, by the way. So Paul introduces them to the idea of moral wrongdoing. Now, in their culture, this is very fuzzy. You know, that there is accountability to a God, kind of not really a big part of their belief structure. kind of like ours. Paul challenges their behavior. He challenges them to repent, to literally change their mind, to abandon one worldview and embrace another. And finally, Paul introduces the one who stands at the center of Christian faith. That would be Jesus, who rose from the dead, and he introduces this to them. This claim stands at direct odds with that culture. That's laughable to them, and there are some in our culture that feel the same way. And Paul's speech also had mixed responses to it. In verse 32, now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer, but others said, "We shall hear you again concerning this." So Paul went out of their midst. But some men joined him and believed him. You know, it's that something that's pretty important here. They went out, and I went forward at the wrong time. They believed him, some of them. It was interesting that Paul said earlier, he does this for some. Some will say that he did not have success here, but in Paul's mind, he absolutely did. Some believed. Paul had mixed responses when he was trying to be the fifth gospel, and I guess all I'm really trying to say here is that when you try to reach the lost, you're probably going to have similar results. And it doesn't feel good when you're being rejected. You know, I'm sure it was much more fun for Paul when there's many people coming to Christ than it is when most of the crowd was heckling you and jeering you and sometimes took you outside and stoned you. That's sad. But he knew what he was doing. He had mixed responses. Some will reject Christ. Some will want to hear more. And some will believe. So it's important for us to understand our job is to faithfully present the gospel, to do it in a way that it can be understood, to do it in kindness and love, to try to get people to ponder the question. Ask them, you know, what Jesus asked Peter is a good one. What do you think of Jesus? What do you think of Jesus? I asked that. My brother-in-law's an atheist. I asked him that one time. And he had quite a bit to say about who he thought Jesus was. And it opened up a door to talk. What a simple question. What do you make of Jesus? Get them to ponder questions like that. It's the Holy Spirit's job to convict them of their sin and bring them to the faith. That's not our job. So more fundamental question. Who is your favorite God? Well, let's consider this as a question that C.S. Lewis asked. What does Jesus Christ make of us? What does he make of us? We need to remind ourselves that the answer is one of love and pursuit. He loves us and he is coming after us. He's chasing us. That he thinks a great deal of us, so much so that he would send his own son to die on a cross. That we might find hope and life and meaning and significance. Not in the things that this world has really, but in the gospel and in Jesus Christ. Christ is the one who gives us our identity. Something to think about the mixed responses that Paul got while in Athens, it reminds us of something, that we are aliens and we are in a fallen world, and that is the world that God has asked us to be faithful witnesses in. If everybody was on the same page, there would be no need for us to be out there preaching and reaching the lost. And when you reach out to the lost, not everybody's going to like it. The world desperately needs Jesus now before he just becomes something written in a book a long time ago that's basically unknown by everyone. Just like the Athenians needed him, Paul's method in Athens was instructive. It was kind. He built a bridge. He started to identify with them, and then he taught them about the God that they didn't know. We need to do the same thing. So at the end of his speech, he focuses on Christ, him crucified and resurrected. And Paul insists that God will judge the world by the man that he has appointed in verse 31. and referring to Jesus, but not really ever mentioning him by name, Jesus has been given all power in heaven and earth. Paul insists that this reality is proven in the fact that God raised him from the dead. Paul has come a long way from his introduction when he got there, and now arriving basically at the essence of the gospel, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's where you're trying to go when you teach people. When you're trying to reach the lost, you have to take them to this point. It is not an unknown God, but a risen Christ with whom everyone will have to deal. Every one of us. So let me encourage you this morning, if you are here and you are not a Christian, let me encourage you to do something really simple. Put on Christ in baptism. Do not let God be unknown to you. You are not unknown to him. Do not let him be unknown to you. Make him the ultimate thing in your life. Won't you come as we stand and sing?